Well, thanks for tuning in this week to Tour Guide Tell All. I'm your host, Candon Arseniega, joined each week by
Rebecca Fackner
and Rebecca Grohl. As I like to think of us, Candon and the Rebeccas.
Where would Dan fit into this?
He'd play the tambourine.
I do like Candon, the Rebeccas, and Tambourine Dan. So we are all tour guides with DC by Foot, the Washington, D.C. branch of Free Tours by Foot. As historians and educators, we want to bring our knowledge and storytelling skills to you each week to tell the stories of American history and DC characters that we aren't always able to get into detail about on our tour. So this week, we are going to chat about Charles Lindbergh in honor of the new series based on Philip Roth's The Plot Against America. So have either of you guys read the book or watched the TV show yet?
So I have read the book. I have not watched the TV show yet. I'm very excited to watch it. I'm definitely the kind of person, though, who once I start something, I want to be able to watch it all in a row. So I think I'm going to wait till all the episodes air, kind of try to keep myself as spoiler-free as I can, maybe on how it's different from the book. And then once it's all out there, then I think I'm going to dive in with my husband and get nitpicky on it. But I'm really excited to see what HBO does with the Roth book because it's a really, really interesting story.
I have read the book many years ago, and I have not seen more than the trailer of the HBO show, although I get the impression it's a little more sensationalized for TV than the book is, but I'm also going to wait until it all is out.
You know what, Rebecca? It's not TV. It's HBO. That was their old marketing slogan.
Do we know how many episodes it's going to be?
It looks as though it'll probably be 6 episodes. Like a 6-part miniseries.
Maybe when it's finished, we'll do a follow-up as we kind of compare and contrast what the real version, like real history versus the a show versus the book, kind of do a compare and contrast to that.
So should we talk about whether it's historically accurate now or at the end and let people kind of learn for themselves as they listen to the real story of Charles Lindbergh? Like, does he run for president?
He does not run for president. He was very politically active. He's active in something called the America First Movement, which I'll talk about. And it is likely that he was approached to run for president, but he does not want to. And that's never a real thing that really happened.
I think what might be best for us is tonight on the podcast, we'll talk about all the real history, all the stuff that happened. And then those who've read the book or those that are excited to check out the TV show, even without having read the book, can watch all the episodes and then kind of see maybe if they listen to our podcast where the real history comes in. And then I agree with Rebecca. I think we should do a follow-up after it's all aired and everyone's had time to digest and be spoiled. And then we can come back and talk about what's real, what's not.
All right. So Charles Lindbergh.
Great American hero. Let's go.
Yeah. Or, you know, not. Yes, then no. Charles Lindbergh. So a disclaimer before I start, the podcast is about scandals and sort of more adult content. And there is going to be some of that in the pod. He does get involved in a few scandals, like as we'll talk about towards the end. But I want to make sure that people are kind of aware Lindbergh was, there's also a darker side to Charles Lindbergh. Lindbergh was a racist and an anti-Semite. That's going to come up in this pod. So if that is not your bag, we don't take offense. Lindbergh is a really great, I think, reminder that history is complicated and messy people make history and no one's all good or all bad. And that's the great thing about this. We can kind of make our own judgments about this.
Well said.
Thank you very much. To start, we're going to start the sort of supporting actor of our story. The second character is the history of aviation. Lindbergh plays a very pivotal role in the development of flight. And so we're going to start in the early 1920s. Aviation is at this point about 20 years old, and so it's out of the infant phase, but is very much a toddler. And in that way, it is pushing its boundaries, doing a lot of stunts, things that its parents probably wouldn't want it to. I'm not going to torture that metaphor anymore, but you get the idea. In the early 1920s, there is a hotel owner named Raymond Ortig, who is not a pilot himself, but he is romanced by the idea of flight, and he decides that he's going to offer a prize of $25,000, which is a lot of money. I mean, it's a lot of money now. It was a lot of money.
A lot of money then.
He's going to offer this prize to the first person or persons who can fly nonstop from Paris to New York, or New York to Paris, doesn't matter, just nonstop. That's the key. And in the early 1920s, this is not possible. It's way beyond our grasp technologically. Ortig renews the prize, and by the spring, sort of early spring, late winter of 1927, this is just at the edge of what human beings can do technologically. And so there are a lot of people who want this money. They want the fame. They want the, you know, to be the first person across the Atlantic. It's a big deal. And so there are a lot of people who are trying to do it. And unfortunately, some of them try and shouldn't. And there are fatalities involved. There are a few sort of very prominent, famous World War I pilots that lose their lives in attempting this. And it gets to the point where the hotel guy, Ortig, is going to cancel his prize because he didn't want to kill people. And into this atmosphere strides this unknown 25-year-old named Charles Lindbergh. Lindbergh is, he shows up in New York with a plane that he designed himself, and he says that he's going to fly from New York to Paris. And on, he's trying to get out in advance of a big storm that's coming from the west. And so on May 20th, 1927, he takes off from Roosevelt Field in New Jersey. It's actually this mall is on the site of the airport now. And he's getting minimal press attention. We are able to track their, well, not we, I wasn't around for this, obviously, but they're able to track his movements up the coast of the East Coast, up through Newfoundland, and then he disappears out over the Atlantic Ocean. We're going to leave him there mid-flight, and we're going to back up and do two things. We're going to talk about Charles Lindbergh's background, and then I want to talk about the plane specifically.
I was going to say, just as a little bit of aviation understanding, it's for people to understand where we kind of are in 1927, we're only about 20 years out of the Wright brothers, right? That's 1903, the first sort of manned flight. Even with the First World War, we're seeing advances in flight, but nothing that can do what Ortig wants, right? To do this nonstop transatlantic, it's not there yet. Lindbergh was not totally new to flight. When he goes to this in 1927, he's an unknown, but he's been in and around planes. Some of his earliest jobs to me are crazy. He's like a wing walker, which to me is the most insane thing that people do. He trains as a kind of a trick, doing all these tricks. And then he does what I think back then was the most insane job a person could have. He was an airmail pilot. Those guys were like the cowboys of the sky. They were pioneering so much in aviation, but they were also daredevils. Part of their training was more time spent on how to parachute out safely than how to actually fly the plane, because they knew more often than not, they'd have to bail out. And in fact, Lindbergh does several times in his airmail career have to bail out because the plane is inevitably going to crash. So when you sort of look at the flying he had done before this prize, it's insane to me because so much of it is so wild. It's so crazy. It's not this big sustained flight. And so even knowing that he has some experience, I'm like always on the edge of my seat when I think about him taking off to do this, because it's so different from any other flying he's done before.
Yes, it is very different. Charles Lindbergh is in 1927, he's 25, but he looks like he's about 16. look at a picture of him. His looks come into play in this. He's very wholesome. He's from a small town called Little Falls, Minnesota. His father was a congressman for a while, so he splits his time as a kid between Washington, D.C. and New York. And in fact, when he's in D.C., he goes to school for a while with a couple of the sons of President Theodore Roosevelt. And he seems, before 1927, he seems to have distinguished himself by really nothing at all. He was very mediocre. He was a mediocre student. No one seems to have had any strong memories of him. And he attempts this flight. And I also want to talk about his plane. The plane today is in Washington still. He's later going to give it to the Smithsonian. It's at the Air and Space Museum. And if you get a chance to look it up, it looks, when you look at it, it's teeny, and it looks like it's made of metal, but it's not. The skeleton is metal, but it has a canvas, basically a shrink wrap around it. It's called a cotton dope. But it would have been like flying in a tent, would have been insanely difficult, insanely cold, and really, really loud. He designs the plane himself, and he uses only the most tried and true technology. He doesn't want anything new. He has basically two pedals and a couple gear shifts, and that's how he flies. He does not have a gas gauge. The technology existed, but he didn't want one. He said he would either have enough gas to make it where he was going, or he wouldn't. Oof. And knowing about it isn't going to make it better. But the really big thing about this plane is he puts the fuel tank in front of the cockpit. So he has, what that basically means in practical terms is he doesn't have a windshield. He has no forward visibility. And you could argue, what was he worried about running into? There was nothing up there. But still, I would imagine that seems to me to be extremely unnerving, flying forward and not being able to see. He does have a side window, but it's quite small. The other thing about this flight that's particularly interesting to me is the way that he calculates his route. So obviously GPS, sonar, radar, they don't exist. None of those things exist in 1927. The way that he calculates where he's going is by something called dead reckoning. Which, do you know what dead reckoning is, Becca?
I don't know, but I don't like the sound of it.
It is a lot of math.
No, see, I knew I wouldn't like it.
Dead reckoning, he basically will plot on a map how fast he's going, how long it has been since he last calculated, and any drift in his route. He does this on a map that's spread out on his lap, holding a flashlight between his teeth, while doing the calculations in his head, while he's trying to fly an unsteady plane with no forward visibility.
Another thing I think to mention too is he's 6'3".
He's tall.
He's a tall guy. So when you're talking about him with this map on his lap, and I've seen the plane because we take groups to the Air and Space Museum all the time. Oh, yeah. And I try to think about this guy who was almost as tall as Abraham Lincoln,
yep.
one inch shy, and he's cramped into this thing. And then he's trying to figure out the map and look at this map. It's hard to envision in my head how he could have fit in there. And then of course there's no meal service, no beverage service.
He brought like a sandwich with him and a bottle of water. And you got to remember
no parachute and
nothing at all. If he crashes, no one will ever hear from him again. And any extra weight he brings is fuel that he is
right.
Gotta trade off the fuel for the weight. So he brings nothing with him. He doesn't bring a toothbrush or a passport or anything. And the flight is 33 hours. At one point to keep himself awake, he's going to dip about 10 feet above the water so that the cold water from the Atlantic Ocean will splash in on him to keep him awake. It is a remarkable flight. And
I get anxious on like a commercial flight. So all of this just sounds terrifying to me.
He's the only pilot that year to take off and land where he says he's going to. And he does it repeatedly. And whatever else Charles Lindbergh was or was not, the flight is, it's hard to overstate just how remarkable a flight this was. He gets to Paris and he circles the Eiffel Tower a couple times and he looks for the airport, which is called Le Bourget. It's no longer there. It's north of the city. And he was figuring, you know, it's like a Tuesday night. He figures it'll be a sleepy little runway. And every time he gets close to where it is on the map, he sees all these people and he realizes that's the airport. It's lit up like Christmas and 150,000 people have flooded out of Paris to Le Bourget upon hearing that he's on arrival. And so he gets mobbed as soon as he lands, which considering that he can't see where he's going, must have been extra unnerving. He is saved by some very quick thinking by the gendarmes. He is brought to the house of the American ambassador and finally gets to sleep. And he wakes up and there is no way to prepare any human being for what awaits Charles Lindbergh. He wakes up and he is instantly the most famous man in the world. the news reaches the United States of his successful flight within like a half an hour. And remember, this is pre-Twitter, pre-social media, pre-telephone. I mean, there's telephones, but like this is the very early days of technology. So people in Washington are celebrating within an hour.
I think that it is very, you could argue that he is at this point our first real 20th century celebrity on that scale. Yes. To a point where everybody in the world knew who he was.
He was probably the first person to have like near universal name recognition. He'll have this sort of tour of Paris. He meets the president. He has a parade. He goes to London and meets the king. It's this huge thing. And Lindbergh figures, okay, I flew over here. I'll just fly back, right?
No, absolutely not.
And the president, Calvin Coolidge at the time, is not about to let the most famous man in the world just fly back.
Do this crazy, insane thing again and risk his life.
So he sends a naval destroyer. And Lindbergh's brought back, and he gets to Washington first. He has what was at that point the largest gathering on the National Mall.
I do like to note this is a little bit of DC pride, but New York City had thought that naturally Lindbergh would go to New York first. When he came back from Europe, the first place Charles Lindbergh would go would be our biggest city, New York City. But instead, because of the pressure from Coolidge and the government, and I think Lindbergh's own kind of connection to politics as a kid, he knew the importance of coming to the nation's capital. So it's announced that he's going to come to DC, and New York had already been planning like ticker tape parade and all this stuff. And then it's like he's coming to DC, our little sleepy, tiny little town in the 1920s. And I just love that. That gives me such pride. And then DC goes bonkers, goes crazy. It is a cluster of people.
And he gets receives the Medal of Honor from President Coolidge. He has state dinner. He goes to Arlington Cemetery and the whole thing. He does end up going to New York. He does have the ticker tape parade down the Broadway.
After he came to DC is the important part.
Sure. And the ticker tape parade is worth mentioning is the largest of it to date. It is orders of magnitude larger than the parade to end the First World War. Mm-hmm. So it is insane. And Lindbergh figures, okay, well, I've done my press bit. Now I can go back to like real life. And then he realizes this is his life now. And for the next couple of weeks, he realizes that this is not going to let up. He is, to give you an example of how fame sort of treats him, he will go to restaurants and literally watch waiters fight over the scraps from his table. He will write checks to people that they will never cash because they frame them for his signature. He sends clothes to the dry cleaner that get torn up because people want a souvenir. Everywhere he goes is mobbed. Everybody wants a piece of him. Everyone wants to bask in his accomplishment. And part of this, you know, he's very handsome, very tall, skinny. He's also extremely shy. And so he's the kind of guy that you can kind of...
He's got that kind of clean cut, wholesome, all-American look. And he's outwardly so modest, right? When he receives all these accolades, he doesn't want to give acceptance speeches. He doesn't want to promote or brag when he comes back. And so all that like modesty and humility really, I think, adds to his appeal. People are so enamored with that.
Absolutely. And he's very much like the 20s is a time of a lot of social change. We're in the midst of prohibition and women's lib. And Lindbergh seems to represent this wholesome America that we've forgotten. And, you know,
I think it's good to note, thinking about what we're going to talk about in a little bit, but he also represents sort of American exceptionalism, right? Post-World War I, right? We're in this technological boom. We're this major world power. And then we have this homegrown boy who can do what no one else in the world could do. And he represents the best of America. Mm-hmm. And I think for some people, he's going to represent a superiority.
And somebody says, hey, we should promote aviation in South America. And so Lindbergh says, okay. And he funds this massive, very ambitious trip to several places in South America. And the key here is he decides that he's going to spend Christmas that year in Mexico City as the guest of the United States ambassador to Mexico City. He's a man named Dwight Morrow. And this is important, not because of Dwight Morrow, But as it turns out, Dwight Morrow has a daughter.
Ah.
Anne Morrow is 21 years old. She's a senior at Smith College. She is pretty, but not beautiful. She's shy. She's very precocious and intelligent. And they fall in love.
Aw.
Sort of.
I like that kind of up to this point too, before he meets Anne, Lindbergh is a bit of like, I don't want to call him like a rube, but he has this, you read about like in his autobiography and Men Who Knew Him, he was kind of a bit of a prude. Like, you know, a lot of these pilots in the 1920s, these were wild guys and they were womanizers and they were out partying. And Lindbergh like never seemed to approve of that. Even as a young man in his 20s, he was always criticizing the time he spent in the Army Air Service. He was sort of chastising these men for being too free and easy in their relationships. So it sort of makes sense that he would settle down.
Becca, are you suggesting that young men in their 20s might be, shall we say, loose with their affections?
Oh, well, I would never. And look, let me say, not that there's anything wrong with that.
No.
But you get this idea of he's sort of this scold and this prude.
Yes.
And so it sort of makes sense to me that he would sort of be attracted to a very sweet, his kind of female counterpart outwardly, right? This very sweet, all-American girl with the...
good breeding, yes. Socially prominent. Her father's very intelligent. He's, you know, very socially connected. And they get married. And they get married. They settle in New Jersey, not too far from her parents. And they both want families. So they start having kids almost immediately. Charles Lindbergh Jr. is born in 1932, I believe. When the baby is about 20 months old, Anne, who is pregnant with their second child, will go up at night to check on the baby and find that his crib is empty and the window to their second story bedroom is open. And if you've ever heard of the Lindbergh baby, this is the Lindbergh baby. Charles Lindbergh Jr. gets kidnapped. His parents pay the $50,000 ransom, but they work with the kidnappers as best they can, but they never see their child again. And in fact, after they pay the $50,000 ransom, the trail for the baby goes cold. And there's months and months of them not knowing what happened to him and sort of the worst kind of limbo. A couple of months later, someone finds the body of the baby. Turns out what ended up happening is the kidnappers had planned this in advance and they had specially made a ladder to accommodate the weight of the kidnapper going up to kidnap the baby. However, they had not taken into account that when you kidnap someone, you have to add their weight to the calculations. And so the ladder hadn't been strong enough to accommodate both kidnapper and baby, and they had fallen. The baby actually died the night he was kidnapped. There's a trial, and through all of this, the Lindberghs are subjected to the most horrific and awful press scrutiny. There are bus tours that go by their house when the trial is going on. People will pay money to fly planes over the courthouse sort of to catch glimpses of them. Someone even sneaks into the morgue and takes pictures of the baby. And obviously they can't be published, but they're available on the black market. And it's grotesque. That's how terrible. Awful this is. I mean, the worst possible thing that can ever happen to a parent has happened to them. Lindbergh spends a lot of this time trying to protect his wife because, again, she's pregnant a second time. He testifies in the trial, and it's horrific. And Lindbergh figures, if this is the price of fame, I don't want it, which...
fair enough.
Fair enough, right? And so him and his wife decide that they're going to take their family, and they move first to England. They move to Kent, and then they move to an island off the coast of Brittany in France. And he continues to promote aviation. He'll remain pretty close to the aviation industry for the rest of his life. And we're in the mid-1930s at this point. And Charles Lindbergh, develops this fascination and very undisguised admiration for Nazi Germany.
I think it's important to note too, he won't be the only American who feels that way. And some of the people that he is associating with are people like Joseph Kennedy Sr. who share that kind of similar point of view. So I just want to kind of note for our listeners too, if you're kind of new to this, that he was not a total outlier in that feeling. And it's just important to keep that in mind.
Absolutely not. And you'll also read sometimes people say things like he fell or he got involved in with the wrong people. No, no, no. This was very much his choice. He didn't get influenced by the wrong people. This was very much his belief. He will be the guest of the Führer at the 1936 Nazi Olympics in Berlin. He goes to Germany a couple times. He's decorated by the Nazi government. At one point, him and his wife decide that they're going to move to Germany. What stops them is in 1938, something called Kristallnacht, which, if you're not familiar, it's this basically orgy of mass violence that against Jewish synagogues and businesses and Jews are attacked, and it's terrible, and it's sort of sanctioned by the Nazi government, and it horrifies the world, and it does horrify the Lindberghs, but sort of in a different way than it horrifies most people. Anne Lindbergh writes in her journal that, and I'm obviously not quoting here, but she basically writes that, you know, you think you can work with these Germans and then they do something undisciplined like this. And how can we go there to live? And what's interesting is that it doesn't make the prospect of living in Nazi Germany impossible. It's not a deal breaker. It's just...
It's also sort of like criticize the act, but not the motivation behind it, which I find interesting. You know, she doesn't like the messiness or the violence. And I think that's Lindbergh, right? And maybe it comes from that upbringing of like, well, I would never commit such an act of violence, but the under-rooting motivation doesn't seem to be questioned.
Right, exactly. And it is also, it's worth stating, there's no evidence to suggest that Lindbergh would have committed or supported atrocities, the types of atrocities that the Nazis will engage in during the war. But when you're friendly with people like that, you don't really get the benefit of the doubt either. So he's sort of atrocity adjacent would be a good alliterative way to put that. Instead of coming to going to Germany, they come back to the United States. And Lindbergh and his wife will go on to have 5 additional children. Lindbergh gets involved in something called the America First Movement. And America First Movement is they're isolationists. And it should be noted that there were many of them. Isolationism was a very sort of prominent viewpoint. The idea is Europe's problems are Europe's problems, and we have our own problems, and we should probably solve those first and not get involved in whatever is going on sort of over there. There is also a strong racial element to this, particularly with Lindbergh. And Lindbergh seems to believe that there are good people and people who should breed. And he's very much involved in eugenics, which is the idea that there are some people who are worth having more of, and there are some people who are worth having less of. And when you talk about having less of a certain type of person, that's really not a pretty picture.
I was just going to say, I think to illustrate a little bit when we're talking about this America First mentality, again, Lindbergh is a very famous person, but he's not alone in this. And to illustrate it, I like to share just a quick little tidbit that I share on our Capitol Hill Scandals tour. I talk about deaths in the Capitol, but one of them is a man named Morris Edelstein. Edelstein was a congressman from New York, a Jewish man. And on June 4th of 1941, so this is as the war is raging, but the United States has not yet entered the war. It's before Pearl Harbor. There is a congressman from Mississippi named John Rankin, and he gets up on the floor of the House and basically rails against any suggestion that the U.S. should ever enter this war. He blames it on an international Jewish brethren and a cabal of globalists. These phrases should be familiar if you've listened to anything regarding this and other times in our history. So you've got this member of Congress standing on the House floor railing and using this kind of language, the same sort of thing that somebody like Lindbergh might agree with or be also advocating. Morris Edelstein is kind of this great American hero, in my opinion. He gets up immediately and he starts talking about how this issue is going to divide us. It's trying to make us see each other as others. He talks about what Hitler is doing to the Jewish people. And he really just says that sort of regardless of race, creed, or color, every American should do what their conscience tells them, what they see is fit. And then Edelstein has a heart attack and dies, which is a sad and tragic thing, but I always think of Edelstein as such a great hero speaking up against this. But if this is what's happening on the floor of the House, you can imagine the conversations people are having in their private homes when they're talking about this war and about being isolationist and about why maybe we should let those problems be there. So I just, for our listeners, just to kind of give a little context there.
Lindbergh goes around because he's famous. He goes around and gives speeches all around the United States. And the speech that in particular I want to draw your attention to takes place actually on September 11th, 1941. So again, we're not in the war yet, but we are headed in that direction. This is a nationally televised speech. It's a big deal. And Lindbergh gets up in front of the audience in Des Moines, Iowa, and he kind of veers off script. Instead of his normal America First idea, Lindbergh, he says that there are three malign forces that are forcing the United States towards this war: the British, the Jews, and the Roosevelt administration. And then he goes on to talk about how there are too many Jews, how they're a bad influence. And he talks about how rather than fight the Germans, we should form an alliance with them.
A neutrality pact, right?
A neutrality pact, exactly. And the speech, he, first of all, in the hall, people are yelling and screaming and booing him.
The Roosevelt administration is the third powerful group which has been carrying this country toward war. Its members have used the...
He will wait until they've stopped, continue on with his speech, and the speech is universally panned. Everyone hates it. It makes headlines. Both the leaders of the Republican Party, Thomas Dewey and Wendell Willkie, will both completely disavow this. Roosevelt himself says that he's convinced that Lindbergh is a Nazi, and this speech finishes him on the national stage. America realizes almost overnight that he is not really the hero that they thought he was. And they take his name off of all the high schools and streets and things that he's been named for. And really, he just, if he had wanted to set his reputation on fire on stage, he could not have done a better job. 3 months later, we're in the war. And it should be said of Lindbergh that as soon as we got into the war, he was 100% pro the American war effort. He actually volunteers to fight, and FDR has to write this very tactfully worded letter, like, thank you, but no, I think we're good. And he is nothing but supportive once America's in the war.
I thought he did fly in the Pacific Theater. Am I wrong about that?
I don't think so. No, he does fly in the Pacific.
I thought I had read somewhere that he fought in the Pacific, but never took up arms against Germany.
He flew 50 missions in the Pacific as a civilian consultant. And Roosevelt did refuse to reinstate basically his commission.
He gets involved in environmental causes. He spends a lot of the rest of his life in Hawaii. He actually dies there of cancer in 1974. And he actually, and just to give you a sense of his personality, he's so organized and anal retentive that he actually has his death certificate filled out in advance. The only thing that is left is the time of death. And that, however, is not the end.
It is not.
He does die. He's not. No, for a long time it was. His wife, Anne, dies in 2001 in her 90s. She's very long lived and becomes a famous diarist in her own right. And after her death, it seems that Charles Lindbergh has a sort of an interesting personal life. He, in the years after the war in the 1950s and early 60s, Charles Lindbergh was conducting not one, Becca, not two, but three long-term extramarital affairs.
That we know about at this point.
That we know about at this point. He has two, in all of them in Southern Germany. Two of them are sisters.
Yeah, sisters, y'all.
Yeah. And they knew that he was involved with both of them. The third woman, we only know her first name. She was his private secretary for a while. She has a son and a daughter by him. She has a son and a daughter. With the other two women, he has a total of seven kids overall amongst the three women. And this comes to light when one of his daughters finds his picture in a newspaper, and she realizes, hey, wait a second. Turns out he had been, he had visited a couple of times a year and under an assumed name.
Ah.
The women knew who he was, like the women he was with having an affair with knew who he really was.
His but children to his children, did not.
He had an assumed name. They knew he was their, they knew he was their dad, but they knew him as Carew Kent.
A great cover name.
A great cover. It's a very like 50s sort of noir cover name. It's great. And these three women raised his children. He supported all three of them financially. By this time, he's quite wealthy.
Those three women keep that secret, which I find amazing considering his fame and notoriety, that these three women are not the ones who sell the story or come forward. And in fact, it's only sort of discovered accidentally.
Yeah, the one of his daughter, in fact, he writes on his deathbed a letter to all three of them begging them not to share his secret with the world.
And the fact that they do is amazing to me.
One of them, the private secretary, to this day, we don't know who she is. We don't know her last name. We don't know the name of her children. They either don't know or more likely have chosen to maintain their privacy. Which
And to make sure people don't think that we're speculating, there was a DNA test done on one set of children. And Anne and Charles' youngest daughter wrote a few years ago, before her death, that this was just evidence to her of all the secrets her father kept, that she felt that she believed 100% that this was something he would do because he was such a cipher to her.
Yeah, she writes that this is further evidence of the Byzantine layers of deception from our shared father. She like contributes DNA to the test. She actually wanted to meet his second, third, and fourth family. And so it's very much like, this is not speculation. This is, they've proven this through DNA that he had this whole other family. And it sort of begs the question, you know, Lindbergh really believed in some people should breed. And that's, you know, that's, I think, why he goes and has so many children. He obviously believed he was one of those special people that should have a lot of kids. So that's the sort of end of his story. And the interesting thing to me is he has a biographer. There's a guy named Scott Berg who writes this excellent biography of Lindbergh, but it comes out before all of this scandal hits. And how Lindbergh managed to do this, neither his biographer nor his wife nor any of his children find out about this. And it is a complete mystery how he managed it.
Considering his fame, to me, it really is mind-boggling, because even in that era, his movements are being reported by newspapers. Even when he sort of falls out of favor with kind of his speeches and his writing, 1939 to 1941, right? Even post-World War II, though, he's still a very famous man. And so it's not that reporters and journalists don't report on what he's doing or where he's going. He is a celebrity through his life. And yet to keep that a secret is amazing to me.
So anyway, that's Charles Lindbergh.
So I do think
good, the bad, and the ugly.
I think it's good or interesting to note that Lindbergh does have a couple spots in DC if you're looking to sort of connect what Rebecca's talked about with kind of some spots in DC that you can visit. I think most importantly, most famously, is the Spirit of St. Louis, the plane at the National Air and Space Museum, which Lindbergh donated himself directly to the Smithsonian Institution. If you, right now, you know, obviously we can't visit. If you go to their website, they did a 3D rendering of the plane a couple years ago as part of the whole renovation of that exhibit. So there's actually great 3D photography and a lot of good information on their website. So you can definitely go look that up. In fact, we can link to that in the episode notes. But a little kind of interesting fact, we talked about DuPont Circle on our episode about Alice Roosevelt Longworth. And if you're in DuPont, on the actual circle itself, there's a beautiful Beaux Arts mansion, the Patterson Mansion, which was built by Robert Patterson. And the Pattersons loaned the mansion to the Coolidges when the White House was being renovated. And when Lindbergh comes to DC after this big flight, and he's this big hero, and there's gonna be all these events, they actually can't like entertain him inside the White House because it's being renovated. So they will actually entertain him at the Patterson Mansion. So if you're outside the Patterson Mansion, that's where Lindbergh was when he first came. And he spoke from the balcony, and there's great photographs of him there on the balcony.
Well, he's forced to speak from the balcony. And in fact, Coolidge and Lindbergh both were sort of shy.
Old Silent Cal.
Very retiring men. And they wanted to do this, you know, meet and greet and sort of Coolidge's bestowing the Medal of Honor on Lindbergh. And they wanted to do this in private. But no. So many people swarm into DuPont Circle and start yelling that they're forced to do this, come onto the balcony and do this in public. They were worried legitimately, the Secret Service were legitimately worried that the crowd would storm the Patterson House. So they have to sort of show the crowd their hero, which is not the president. So that's another very prominent sort of Lindbergh spot.
And then I think if anything we've talked about on tonight's podcast is of interest, I would really recommend listeners to go to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum's website. The Holocaust yes. Museum has great online resources related to all of this, but particularly an exhibit that they unveiled almost 2 years ago, Americans and the Holocaust. As a tour guide, I love this exhibit because a lot of the groups we bring are American students, so middle schoolers, high schoolers, and they're learning about the Holocaust, and they really learn about what's happening over there. And what the Americans and the Holocaust exhibit does is really starts in 1939 and shows what America knew. And it shows it from the American point of view. And Lindbergh, America First, all of that plays a really important role in the exhibit. And so if you go to their website, they have some really great resources where you can understand a little bit more. Lindbergh, again, I've said this, so I don't want to beat a drum on it, but Lindbergh's not the only person in the United States in the late 1930s, early 1940s, who's advocating these racial ideas, these ideas of eugenics, this very isolationist mentality. And Lindbergh is so prominent because of his celebrity and all of his charm and all of this, the reasons people love him. But he's one of many, including members of Congress, including business and corporate figures. And I think the Holocaust Museum exhibition does an incredible job of sort of painting that picture along with those who are trying to get refugees and people like Eleanor Roosevelt who are trying to push FDR to accept children. So if you go to their website, there's really, really good resources. And I hope when the museum reopens, they're going to keep that Americans and the Holocaust exhibit on display for a little while longer, because I think it's really relevant now even more than ever. Wow. I learned a lot, Rebecca, a lot about Lindbergh. A lot I suspected, but then to see it all laid out is tough. I certainly think, if nothing else, too, he's a really good benchmark for what's happening in our country from 1900 to the mid-century, right? He's such a great illustration of what many Americans are thinking, feeling, how America's changing in the first half of the 20th century, both internally and on the international stage. So you can really use him as a benchmark to kind of see where we're at.
He also is really, really important in propelling a lot of American innovation as far as aviation. A lot in the 10 years after his flight, we had been falling behind the game as far as aviation, and Lindbergh's flight really sparks our imagination to sort of propel us forward. And within 20 years, we are leading the world in terms of aviation.
One thing he's advocating for, even as an isolationist, but he's saying, if anyone's going to win this war and beat the Germans, we have got to invest in flight. And it's going to be an air war. It's going to be about who has the stronger air power. And he's even though he's against the idea, right, he's against us entering this war, he's also very pragmatic. And he's like, look, we've got to be better flyers. We need better innovation. We have fallen behind. Wow. So I think anyone who's like listening to this now and hasn't read the book, truly, you like ended at the perfect point to be like, now go pick up The Plot Against America, and you can see where the fictional alternate history Philip Roth creates comes from, because it is fictional, but it is rooted in so much very, very real emotion and character of Lindbergh.
I'm really excited to watch the show now.
I can't wait. And certainly we'll be posting a little bit on our Facebook page and on our Twitter and Instagram page as the show airs, so we can kind of touch base. And I think we'll definitely do a follow-up little episode once we've watched the whole series and we can see how accurate it is.
Should we binge it together and live tweet our...
Oh, that's kind of time. I like that this was suggested by the one of us who has two children under the age of 5.
Right. Yeah, I will be very, like everything in my life, I will be very far behind because it takes forever for me to have time.
That said, if you are interested in following us along in sort of a live tweet scenario, us dropping history as it happens, we're doing a very special virtual experience called Lincoln's Last Day. This year marks the 155th anniversary of Lincoln's assassination at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. We do a Lincoln assassination tour that's really popular, but of course, we're not doing tours right now. So we're bringing this tour to life with a multi-sensory event. We're going to have videos, photos, lots of cool information and content. We're doing a live chat geared just for students. And then as the day unfolds on April 14th, we're going to be sharing information with you as those things happen in 1865. In addition to that, we'll be dropping some videos leading up to and after Lincoln's Last Day. And for our Patreon supporters who we love so much, they'll be getting a first listen to a special podcast we have on the curse of Robert Todd Lincoln. If you're not a Patreon supporter yet, that's okay. You'll get the Robert Todd Lincoln podcast after our Lincoln's Last Day event. But if you want to get it early, be sure to sign up on Patreon.
Tour Guide Tell All is created and produced socially distant in our respective basements and living rooms straight from Washington, D.C. If you want to support us, please subscribe to our podcast so you'll get alerts when we release new episodes. Give us 5 stars on any and all podcast apps. Find us on social media at Free Tours by Foot and Free Tours by Foot HQ on Facebook and YouTube. But the best way to support us is to give us your money. We want to give a special thanks to our patrons, and you can be one too, by signing up to our Patreon page in the show notes. You'll get early access to podcasts and YouTube videos, tell us who you want us to talk about, and at some levels, get to call in live and listen to us record an episode. So until next week.
Perfect.
Thanks, ladies.
Bye. All right, bye, guys. Thank you.